Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper on Sunday, May 20th, 2018. Mm-hmm. It's been quite the weekend.
Weather-wise,
yes. It was pouring rain. We actually were deterred from doing our 50-mile bike ride that we had planned.
That's right, by the shore.
So by the shore.
It's very nice usually this time of year, but you know, when it's rained out, and Saturday it was rained out.
Super rain. Well, right. No, I'm sure the ride, it was for MS.
Right, but...
And I'm sure the ride went on, but
we did not go on.
It was really...
Can't imagine anybody doing that ride. But
it did not seem like fun.
And we're coming up next weekend's Memorial Day.
So we're hoping for better weekend weather.
Right.
Next weekend. Mm-hmm. Okay, so... Word to the wise, start prepping for your fabulous Memorial Day festivities now, all right?
As we will be.
Yes, we will be out shopping for the weenies, etc.
Right, but the upside of not going on that bike ride Saturday was the opportunity to watch the royal wedding.
Yes, there is that. Since I was not loading the bike onto the car...
Right.
At 6 a.m., I could watch the wedding.
And how was it? I missed it. How was it?
Well, I think it was, I think everybody thought it was fabulous. I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great wedding. It was a whole great thing, great event. Harry and Meghan. So I did find out which prince it was. It's Harry.
Right.
The ginger.
Right.
Okay. So now I know all about that.
It's good.
Everything about it was good. Tremendous drama, family drama, mm-hmm. Leading up and all kinds of preparations, fabulous ceremony, wonderful American preacher giving a nice, gospel-esque fire and brimstone kind of sermon. So it was everything you wanted it to be. It had tradition. It had new fabulous additions from across the pond,
mm-hmm.
from those upstart Americans, fabulous clothes. The celebrities all seemed to be having fun. They were gabbing away and wearing terrific outfits. So it was kind of a win-win, I think.
Yeah. Well, listen, that sounds great. I have to say that the wedding, the juxtaposition of the wedding and the rain here, I couldn't help but for me to bring to mind the famous lawsuit of Krell versus Henry. You may recall that one.
Well, this is the great thing. You like to reframe life into either math or law.
Let me explain.
So if somebody says, oh, watching the wedding, your mind immediately goes to...
Krell v. Henry. Well, Krell v. Henry was a case that you'll recall, 1903, and it involved the coronation of King Edward VII and Queen Alexandra. It's just one of a string of what are called the coronation cases, and those cases emerged from a fact circumstance that could have been this one, which is what happens if you make all these arrangements for a wedding, royal wedding, and it rains, and it gets postponed. People make hotel reservations or B&B reservations or other reservations to be in a particular place to watch the procession, and the procession may be delayed a week.
So it's terrific to be thinking that was going on in 1903 or whatever
it
was,
right?
Okay, because we still have that today. People were lined up for days in Windsor, right? And people line up, people probably rent places on Central Park West for like the Macy's Parade, so they can be looking out the window as opposed to standing there on the ground.
And that's what happened to this fellow Krell, who booked a room in a hotel for June 26th and 27th in 1902, I guess.
1902?
And the case was in 1903. And what happened was Edward VII got sick and it was postponed a week. So when it came time to pony up and pay, Krell said, I shouldn't have to pay because the whole point of this transaction was for me to see the wedding. And that resulted in a seminal decision.
No, the coronation.
See the coronation. You're absolutely right.
From the window. I have no interest in renting this place.
Right.
Unless there's something
to watch. So the question was, did he have to pay or not under those circumstances? And the answer is, what do you think?
He did not?
He did not. He did not have to pay. Notwithstanding that the contract said nothing, the written contract said nothing about his having an excuse if, in fact, there was a delay. The court ruled that there is an implied condition in this case that the coronation were to take place as planned. Implied condition being a new thought, a new concept in contract law, which gave rise to the doctrine of frustration of purpose. The purpose of the contract had been frustrated by the circumstances. So just a little footnote.
This ends up being applied to a lot of situations?
It could be, yeah.
Yeah.
It has a widespread application.
Because it is very confusing and upsetting to me, because I usually say, if it's not in the contract, you know, who cares?
You're usually right. but that's what makes this
but
case.
But it's implied.
It's implied. You know. That's what made it a groundbreaking result. So in any event, so there was something in the royal wedding for both of us.
Beside the fascinators.
Exactly. So on Thursday.
I have to say that Dixon, in order to celebrate the royal wedding, made the most fabulous scones.
Oh, that was
I
for
have
the royal
ever,
wedding? I just
yes, that was
baking.
In honor of the royal wedding, mm-hmm. because, you know, the Brits, they like their scones.
All I know is I turned around that morning and Dixon was standing next to me with a bunch of scones and I couldn't figure out why. But
it was a scone emergency.
Apparently.
And they were terrific.
Yes.
And I know my scones.
Yes. On Thursday, we were at the theater.
Again?
Yes.
You know, it's like we're constantly at the theater.
We're at the theater a lot. We saw
Children of... To put it more aptly, I am constantly in
the
Lincoln Tunnel.
Right. Well, that's like on the way to the theater. We saw Children of a Lesser God, which is the play that many people know, I think, is the one about the young woman who's deaf. And
it's the relationship between a young deaf woman and her teacher.
Right.
Who becomes her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it's interesting because this was a play which really was a sensation in the late 70s. It was written in 1979, presented first in the UK, came to New York in 1980, and won every possible award. It won Best Actor for John Rubinstein. It won Best Actress for the young deaf woman who's playing the student here. And it won the Tony Award for Best Play. It's quite a sweep, very impactful. And now we're seeing it.
And then it was a movie. Was it a success as
a movie?
It was a movie.
No, not terribly. But
okay.
1986.
Right.
And that was with William Hurt and Marlee Matlin, who I think did win Best Actress in Hollywood.
For an Oscar.
Yeah.
An Oscar.
And
we didn't go to this of our own volition.
Well, no.
We had a subscription. It was a roundabout.
Yes, but I was interested in going. And the play... wasn't great.
Which was astonishing because we, you know, have a clear recollection of just how popular it was during the 80s. We were living in New York at the time, and for whatever reason, we never saw it, but it was a hit.
Yeah, well, let's just say before, you know, not to criticize the cast, I mean, this woman, Lauren Ridley, who is nominated for a Tony for Best Actress as the young deaf woman, was extremely good. Joshua Jackson played the teacher husband, and he was very good, and he's apparently known to a lot of folks for his role in Dawson's Creek and in the Mighty Ducks. Apparently he was the lead young hockey player who apparently that's made him quite famous, but he was quite good. And yet, it wasn't really well-reviewed. It's not just us that weren't really that thrilled. No one was thrilled. Most people found it terribly politically incorrect, the idea that the husband slash teacher is sort of sweeps in and takes over for this young woman, and in many people's views oversteps the appropriate bounds as a teacher and becomes her lover and her savior in his own mind. People thought that was inappropriate and therefore was terribly dated and unfortunate. I didn't really feel that way, but
The key conflict was whether she did not want to try to learn to speak.
That's right.
And it is possible for deaf people to speak, to learn to speak. But she was adamantly against it. And so part of the theme is, who are you, you know, Mr. Teacher, to tell me how I need to communicate and how I need to live?
But that's
and it was also about not seeing deafness as so much of an impairment.
Right.
As just, you know, a different way of being and expressing one's...
So those were the key dramatic points, both in 1979 and now, and yet big success then, and not well received now. So what's the difference?
Yeah, I don't know. I did tell you that I found it tedious because the Joshua
Jackson
yeah. character, the teacher, not only speaks his own lines,
right.
but also interprets her sign language,
right.
even though to some extent there are subtitles
right.
Projected on the over the stage. And that didn't work for me.
Right.
And I can't put my finger on why.
Well, I think it's obvious why. You're hearing only one voice, and it's not even the most expression full, and it's not a voice filled with expression because he's translating. And there's a flat tone in terms of translating. So you're hearing the same half monotone throughout.
Right. It's like when you hear a news report and
right.
somebody is speaking in Arabic, you know, with great enthusiasm and emotion. And then the reporter translates
right.
it.
Not the same.
And so there was a little bit of that. Also, I mean, the actress was terrific and very expressive and really made sign language come alive. Even though I didn't understand it.
Right. Look, I think it's got to be a factor, and this is something you mentioned before. It was new, it was different, it was novel in 1979. And just the idea of as you told me before, of having, of recognizing.
That deafness is a difference, not
right.
an not a disability.
Right.
So
looking beyond the superficial limitations
yeah.
of a character like this was considered so groundbreaking and exciting. That I think that carried it a long way.
Yeah.
And the idea of having someone on Broadway stage who was deaf, who was signing most of the time, was brand new. None of these things are brand new now. So,
right.
You know, not the greatest, but, you know, it's not the worst, and it's playing through the end of the month.
So speaking of not the greatest, my drive-in that night was really horrendous.
People want to hear about this.
Horrendous.
and
I crawled, once I did manage to get it, I crawled to the restaurant.
Which was
that
great.
We had arranged to meet at.
And?
Uncle Vanya's.
54th Street between 8th and 9th.
Cleverly right across from a precinct.
Which is not sufficiently fortified for that neighborhood. It is a neighborhood. It was like, look, we talk about the Americans all the time, which is the great television show with the Russians who have infiltrated a suburban area in the U.S. And they're leading a double life. So we're in this restaurant, which looks like an outtake from the Americans.
Well, we're immediately immersed in sort of an expatriate Russian
only Russian smoking, you know? Only Russian beer, Russian food, and there's no, which is all fine.
It was small, it was dark.
The menus are from the old Soviet Union. Hadn't been dusted off since then. The food was quite good.
Yes, we had herring, we had sprats.
We had dumplings.
We had kasha.
Oh, yeah. And it was great. And the funny thing is, in all this scene, and it is a, let me put it this way, rundown restaurant, and we're the only ones in it at the beginning until a couple of big guys like me come in.
Well, there were some large Russian men.
Right, like myself. And then, on top of that, the soundtrack, they're playing music from The Doors. They're playing apocalyptic music from The Doors. They're playing Riders on the Storm. And
it was an otherworldly experience.
Break on through to the other side.
So what I decided
yes.
is that we should have a watch party there for the finale of yes. The Americans.
Yes, please write in if you're up for that. Because let me put this, the Americans could...
Kasha for everyone.
Americans could do much worse than in their final episode, set it in Uncle Vanya's and play The Doors on the soundtrack. That would be spectacular. And I hope they're on to that. It might be too late, though. Uncle Vanya's, we recommend it. So the biggest development in the news, in my mind, certainly the sports news this week, is sports gambling. Okay? Sports gambling.
Right, so now that's permitted.
Yes. So there's a lot of excitement.
R.I.P. Bill Bradley's dream of
keeping
sports betting out of most of America.
Yes, Bill had a law which says the states can't do something. It turns out that the feds can't just write laws that say the states can't do something. They can do something on their own, but they have to do a little more than what they did. So the law's out. The states are going to be dealing with gambling. And interestingly, there's a lot of reaction to this in the Journal and the Times. The lead article in the Journal was Get Ready to Hate Sports. It's just what some people
think. So why is that?
Well, because they feel, first of all, a lot of people are seeing some hypocrisy in this, and that on the one hand, different sports themselves have always said they want nothing to do with gambling. And as soon as this development took place, they all said, well, we want nothing to do with gambling, but since there's going to be gambling, let's do it right. We want it on mobile phones.
But there's always been gambling. The states will get their piece of the pie.
And it's going to be more accessible. And as the journal points out, being more accessible means there will be more gambling. And it is, a recessive tax. It's always been looked at, as the journal calls it, an inferior good is what they call in economics, which means more people in lower income will do this than people in higher income. Yes, it will be a tax. The money will go to the state, but it's a recessive tax. In other words, it's one where the most of the money for the government from this particular tax will come from lower income people as opposed to higher income people. That's not been the progressive way things go. So people don't love that part of it. But on the other hand, there is a lighter side. They do this in Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And they do this in spades in Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And the Times is covering that in an article. They say that people place wagers before the game and during the game. They wager, and of course it's soccer or football there, they wager on who will score the next goal or how many goals will be scored in the final 10 minutes.
Hmm.
Right? So you're sitting there and you're watching the game with your mobile phone. And yes, you may have bet before the game, but you're in the middle of the game saying, I bet so-and-so will score the next goal, and you place a bet from your armchair in the middle of the game. And not only that, but they will fix up a wager for you. In other words, they say, tweet us. These are the various betting organizations they have. Here's an ad. Tweet us. We can price your bet in 15 minutes. So if you and your friend come up with a bet saying, let's bet on, the next fellow who gets injured in the game, they can dial up these folks and say, okay, we'll give you these odds. And now you have your own bet that you just came up with.
Okay.
And how is this in Britain? They say, well, in Britain, even Queen Elizabeth is known to, quote, fancy a flutter. That's the phrase they use.
What does that mean?
That means a bet. Fancy putting a wager on something.
Well, it is going to kind of ruin things in some ways, because it'll be like the football pool stuff. It's like, oh, good, this team is winning. And then you'll say, nah, they're not covering my points.
Yes, you're right.
And then you're in a bad mood, even though the team is winning or whatever. You can't win.
Now, you're right. It's going to change things in a lot of ways. And I don't disagree with the thing you're saying. It's going to take away from the traditional sports allegiance, the sports rooting. Just rooting for the team because you're rooting for your home team is just going to be all about money. And on top of that, people are going to lose money. And why do I say that? And then going back to another article in the journal called Finally, the Freedom to Lose Our Shirts. This is by Joe Queenan, who writes a column in the journal, who says that gambling is one of the few for-profit enterprises that rely on the chronic inability of its clientele to get things right. The others are Wall Street and the weight loss industry. That's what happens.
People, but isn't the lottery the same thing?
Yes, the lottery is the same thing.
Okay.
The lottery is the same thing. As he puts it, for gambling to succeed, a large segment of the betting public has to regularly, indefatigably, back the wrong horse.
Right.
And they do. Right. I have never met a successful gambler, not one. All right, so that's the Brave New World. But speaking of backing the wrong horse.
Just one minute.
Yes.
I'm just thinking about tweeting. Who would I tweet when I want to say something like, who sells more cheesecake?
There are
Lindsay's
outfits.
Or Junior or whatever.
It's
like
not
that.
Hard because in Great Britain, they actually have the names and the phone numbers of the booking agencies on the uniforms of the players in these games.
Oh, okay.
Right. It's very easy to get. It's displayed all over the place.
This is going to be interesting.
Yes, it is. Yes, but anyway.
I'm happy for some of these small places like Monmouth Raceway.
Yeah.
I mean, they're dying for this because people are, not doing horse races.
Even Pimlico.
Yeah.
Even Pimlico, where they hold the Preakness and they had 137,000
people
they're
ready
on Saturday.
To roll. They were talking about they can be
They've
set
got their
up to
machine
take
set
bets,
up.
By this weekend.
They need it. Oh, so they have 137,000 on Saturday, and on a regular Saturday, they draw fleas. They can't get anybody in there, but this will help
them. The Preakness
is the one.
That was shocking.
Okay.
That was shocking. That was like a foot of mud.
Right. And there are people that are in the mud.
In the rain, in the mud.
Just to come clean.
130,000
Yes. So we have, I have mentioned two horses in connection with the two races, the Derby and the Preakness. Not necessarily saying that they'd win, but saying that they were worth your interest and investigation. What's interesting is they both finished last. They didn't just win. It's a very hard thing to do.
It seems hard to pick out exactly who will come in last.
Thank you very much. It was Mendelsohn in the first race.
Daniel, you are a genius.
And Quip in the second. I will tell you right now. It is harder.
You've outdone yourself.
It is harder to pick the horse that finishes last than the horse that finishes first.
So you've got some time to come up with the last
place. I'll be making a pick.
At the Belmont.
In the Belmont in a week or so. And I will tell you right now, I'm going to use my same method. I'm going to think about who I think might win the race. That's just my method.
So that's your strategy.
But that will come.
And we can all be sure that will be the horse that loses.
That's the way it's looking so far. But stay tuned for that. That's a very valuable point.
3 weeks we got.
This will be an unparalleled accomplishment if I can pick the horse that comes in last 3 times in a row. It'd be pretty amazing. So you had something about.
Well, I have a lot of things. First of all, I just want to say it's been very hot today. Yesterday was super cold,
humid,
and rainy.
Yeah.
Today was super hot. It was in the 80s.
Right.
So it made me think about Hawaii and the volcanoes and how hot all of that is.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, there was a little article in the Times about how hot is molten lava.
And it's hotter than it is today?
It turns out there are three different levels, which are kind of interesting. And the red molten lava, called felsic lava, is 1100 mm-hmm. degrees Fahrenheit to like 1472.
Right.
Okay. And then the orange mm-hmm. lava, all right, is even hotter. That's 1472 to 1832.
Right.
And the hottest lava is yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 1832 to almost 2200 degrees Fahrenheit. I just thought that was interesting because I didn't really realize that yellow is hotter than red. And so that puts colors in an interesting perspective to me. So there you have it. You know.
All right.
We have been to Volcano National Park, which is closed at the moment.
Yes.
Moving right along, I also wanted to talk about procrastinating.
Right.
And apparently this is a thing. This is a thing. This is what you do if you have other stuff you should be doing, okay? It's a way to sort of put off what you need to be accomplishing. And it's often done before big exams, before taxes are due.
Right.
And they do say that online, you know, there's an awful lot of pictures of baking on Instagram, etc. And that pictures of baking spikes during these periods because everybody is
procrastinating.
Yeah. And it's unnecessary baking. And if possible, you do something that takes a long time. This one lady says, I make macaron because those are really complicated and it can take 3 days to get it right. Mm. And you're busy doing something. So, you know, even though you should be doing something else, it's not like you're just sitting there lounging about eating bonbons.
You know, it makes you rethink Dixon and those scones really on Saturday morning and what was really going on there.
All right. And nice, Dan. Nice. You know, anything we can do to keep Dixon making those scones is worth it. All right. And then again, on the food and drink side of things, this little article I dedicate to our buddy Armand, because it was an article in the New York Times about session cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So number one, I was interested in that word session.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we had been to a local beer tasting, a brewery tasting room
mm-hmm.
For Free Will,
mm-hmm.
which is a brewery that's actually headquartered in Perkasie.
Right.
And so you were discussing possible styles of beer that they produce,
right.
and they mentioned session. Okay. So immediately I was thinking, is this a funny way of people pronouncing saison? Which is another kind of beer.
Right.
And when I read this article, I thought, well, maybe not, because it defined session cocktails as low alcohol cocktails, okay? And possibly the word came from an English expression for, you know, session drinking or whatever, where you are planning a big night of drinking, so you want a low alcohol beer or drink so you can make it through the night. Not so fast. Turns out saison beers were also brewed to be low alcohol.
No, I know that. I know that. But is it coming from a different place?
Well, I think it's kind of a combination or maybe even a mispronunciation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know how the Brits love to butcher French. Mm-hmm. So anyway, fun article about these interesting cocktails with a lower alcoholic content for a variety of reasons. You may want to drink more. You may not choose to be drunk on your first drink. The article also says that bartenders sometimes choose to imbibe during their work, and they don't want highly alcoholic drinking while they're working as well. And so the definition of it shouldn't have any more than like 3/4 of an ounce of strong spirits in it. Now, it turns out that back in the day, like 19th century-wise, martinis actually had a whole different ratio of gin to vermouth, as opposed to 4 or 5 to 1 gin to vermouth. They were like equal parts gin to vermouth. And it's a later mid-20th century thing that it became more alcoholic and a stronger drink.
Oh, it became more, okay.
Yeah. So people are reviving this idea of interesting but lower alcoholic drinks. And somebody's come out with a nice recipe book, Drew Lazar, Session Cocktails, Low Alcohol Drinks for Any Occasion, that looked pretty fun.
Okay.
But you probably need a strong drink if you're going to head on to the New York subway system.
Well, listen, it almost doesn't pay to talk about the subways. There have been articles about the subways for years, and those of us riding the subways know that they're not very good.
And they get worse and worse.
So the Times has an article, and they've written many articles, and they're usually pretty good. And this one's called Two Decisions Pushed Subway into Crisis. And this one is particularly interesting, and this is the reason why. The MTA has said for years that the reason that the subways are operate so poorly and are delayed so often is because of overcrowding. And it turns out that that's just not true. That ridership between 2013 and 2018 has decreased.
Really?
And decreased significantly.
Wow.
And what makes this article so interesting, and this is so clear that recently the MTA owned up to this. They said that was kind of a lie. So what's interesting about the Times article is they're able to trace what's happened to the subway to two particular decisions. One to slow down trains, and another that tried to improve worker safety. But neither of these moves make any sense in retrospect, and they are the reason that we have the problems we have. And here's what they say. These are the two things the MTA did over the years. One is they decided to increase the amount of space required between trains. And they installed or modified hundreds of signals which regulate train spacing. And in that process, the signals throughout the system were misconfigured, set up in such a way that slowed the trains down even more than the officials intended. So they screwed up the signals.
Right.
And first of all,
for no particular reason.
For not a good reason.
Right.
And the second, that the agency adopted new rules for track work that expanded safety zones and increased setup times. In other words, when you see work being done in the subway, you obviously have to be concerned about workers who are in a particular place and slowing down.
Right.
But by dint of negotiations for the unions or whatever, they expanded the zones for far outside where the work is being done. And what you have is a low speed limit, even 10 miles an hour, when you're a significant piece from where the work is actually happening.
So it's more disruption.
So it's much more disruption
than is necessary.
And if you put this together, you have a problem. And there's one other point that they make in the article, which adds to it. And that is because these signals are misconfigured, they're not entirely reliable. So what happens is when someone who's a conductor on a train is approaching an area where it's not clear what the speed ought to be, whether it be a slowdown or not, and a signal comes and there's some concern that maybe the signal's right or maybe it's not or maybe it's contradictory, the engineer will always slow down the train to an extremely slow speed. And the reason is simple. The engineers are penalized if they ever go above the speed they should be going, but they are not rewarded in any way for being on time. And the penalties are real. So if you're caught once or twice going above the correct speed limit, if you're getting an ambiguous signal and you read it the wrong way, there's significant penalty. You can be discharged. If you run your train in such a way that you try to make the train on time and make adjustment that way, you get no benefit at all.
So the system is sort of crafted to slow everything down.
That's right. The
system's
fixed.
Because they can't figure out how fast they should be going, they go extra slow.
That's right. Yeah. And the whole thing, the impetus for it was kind of ill-conceived from the very beginning, but it's now hardwired into the signals and they can't unhardwire it, or it'll take an enormous effort to do it. So that's what's really going on with the subways, according to the Times, and it sounds right.
Well, it's a mess.
Yes.
But now we know why.
Yes.
All right, so I have an obituary here that's kind of interesting. Doreen Simmons, British expatriate, who became a voice of sumo wrestling. And it's really a wonderful article about a woman who actually had been a teacher of Latin and Greek in England, ends up in Singapore, eventually in Japan, and she becomes obsessed with sumo wrestling. And she actually lives in a part of town where there are sumo stables where these guys train. And so it's part of the atmosphere of where she lives. And she finds herself, getting involved in the sport. She becomes kind of an expert. She does some writing about the matches and then is approached to do color commentary for the English radio station broadcasts. And she really becomes a renowned expert in sumo wrestling. Now, her advice, if you want to get into sumo wrestling, is to go to the lesser matches. Go to the beginner matches because no one will be there. And you can really get close to the action. You can really get a chance to begin to understand what's going on. But it's a fun obituary and has lots of, kind of details. She really had a profound knowledge and could explain different influences and how the sport was adulterated at certain points.
Well, it's totally incongruous. And I guess you ought to credit them for bringing her in to do the commentary because she looks like a little old lady. And you're going to bring in to talk about
she would be great on What's My Line or something, right? You would never guess that she is a sumo wrestling expert.
Yeah.
An aficionado.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So that was fun. Find your niche.
Yeah. All right. Well, to go back to a more American sport, basketball, just for the moment, they're doing
talk about big people.
Yes.
Talk about big in a different way.
Big, yes. And, of course, the playoffs are going on and... You know, it looks like Golden State's
the NBA
going to win again, but we'll see. I mean, I hate to make a prediction in light of what's been going on here, but Golden State looks like the best team in the Final Four.
But they could come in last because that sometimes happens with your predictions.
Yes, thank you. But the question really is, the real challenge is who's the next great team? And is it the Celtics? Is it the 76ers, which people around here like to think? And the answer is no. And I'm going to tell you right now. It's the L.A. Clippers. And why is it the L.A. Clippers, you ask me, Tamsin?
Why?
It's because of a man named Jerry West. Jerry West, the logo. And you know why he's called the logo.
No, I don't.
Okay. You've seen the NBA logo, which is a basketball player dribbling in profile with his left hand. You've seen it.
So that's a high contrast image of Jerry West?
It is. Okay. It is Jerry West.
All right. How cute is that?
He's the logo for a reason. Right. And he was the face of the NBA, the top player for years. That was before Michael Jordan. But let's just leave it as a great basketball player. But more importantly for this conversation, a great general manager. So he went from being a basketball legend to going to the Los Angeles Lakers front office, where, of course, they had great success. And guess what team he's been involved in for the last few years until now? That's right, the Golden State Warriors. And at a certain point, Jerry West got in his head that now that he's reached the age of 80, he doesn't get as many phone calls asking for advice, asking him what to do at the Golden State office because they're looking to younger operatives to run things now.
Okay.
And he, at the age of 80, needs a greater challenge. So he's moving on to the LA Clippers, the team owned by Steve Ballmer, ex of Microsoft, who's got a zillion dollars. And between Ballmer's money and Jerry West taking on the new challenge, even at 80, that's a good bet.
Really? Yes. So you don't think it's in the coach, and you don't think it's in the players? You think it's in the general
manager? I think the general manager picks the players. I think the coach helps, but nothing's more important than the players. And if you have the right management and the right financial acumen, you're likely to succeed.
But you don't think the Sixers are due?
I think the Sixers will get there, and when they get to the final, they're going to play the Clippers and lose. That'll be in about 2 years.
You heard it here first.
Exactly. Yes. We had an interesting book review.
Interesting is one way to talk about it.
It's
right up your alley.
When Einstein worked with Gödel.
Gödel.
Kurt Gödel, who's the mathematician. The title comes from the fact that Einstein and Gödel were at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in the 30s, and they were best buddies, Einstein being the leading light in physics, Kurt Gödel in mathematics, and Jim Holt, who's the author of this book, was imagining conversations between them. But
as they're walking around Princeton.
Yes.
And much like our own conversations.
If he only knew
it's
of us.
It's surprising Jim Holt is not writing about our conversations.
Well, maybe his next book.
Of Princeton.
He's not done. But his approach here, which is kind of interesting, as he describes it, is getting across a profound idea in a brisk and amusing way to an interested friend by stripping it down to its essence. The goal is to enlighten the newcomer while providing a novel twist that will please the expert. And this is challenging subject.
I think that's a very good approach. And I think that's a very 21st century approach. Mm-hmm. You know, you're trying to come up with sound bites, but intelligent kind of sound bites, engaging ways of expressing information. So I got that.
The book gets into metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, and according to the reviewer, Parul Segal, it's an interesting read.
There you lost me. How could this possibly be interesting?
She says Holt is an amphibious kind of writer. So there you go. Slipping from theology to cosmology to poetry. I don't know. But here's an interesting concept that came up from whether we get this book or not. I'm a little more intrigued than you are, obviously, but we were both interested in this. The word scientist, and this is the Holt report in this book. It was only coined in 1833, which is relatively recent.
Because it comes from the word for knowledge, scientia.
Does it?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Well, what Holt says, you can tell me if this is right. Holt says that until 1833, science was pretty much bound up with philosophy, and it wasn't considered a separate discipline. But then, as the 19th century wore on, it became recognized as a separate discipline. And philosophy, if anything, kind of withered in importance.
Because the interest in science blossoms.
Right. And philosophy was tied up with religion, and the significance of religion is diminished. So philosophy diminishes, science takes hold, and it's in the forefront. And I think he's right about that. That's the kind of insight you can expect to see in this book that you're so dismissive of.
Right. But, what I think appealed to you really about this review, and I'll be amazed if you read this book, is this paragraph. Part of what makes Holt so exciting is his ability to gather these disciplines under his shingle, to make their knottiest questions not only intelligible but enticing without sacrificing rigor. People who are otherwise cultivated will proudly confess their philistinism when it comes to mathematics, Holt writes. The problem is they have never been introduced to its masterpieces. Proofs can resemble narratives with plots and subplots, twists and resolutions. It is this kind of mathematics that most people never see. True, it can be daunting, but great works of art, even when difficult, often allow the untutored a glimpse into their beauty.
Well, now I'm more excited than ever.
Yes, I mean, for you, it always comes down to math and the law. Holt reminds us, Thomas Jefferson said that thinking about mathematics helped beguile the wearisomeness of declining life. Bertrand Russell claimed it was the only thing that kept him from suicide.
Okay, so you're on my side.
So mathematics, obviously going to save the world.
Well, listen, talk about what I'm interested in. Now let's switch to what you're interested in, which is...
No, I'm not. It's not like I'm interested in this, but
it's
this
a little grisly.
Curious,
go ahead.
A little curious story about a mummified hand that I guess he's an anthropologist, came across. It was from a cache of graves from southern Hungary, and a little town, and most of the bones dated from somewhere between the 12th and 16th century. And there was this little teeny weeny skeleton that he found where a lot of the bones had actually turned green.
Right.
And in fact, the hand, one hand, had become mummified. In other words, it still had the skin on it, like a mummy. And he found this very curious. And when he analyzed, they analyzed the composition of these bones, and they had a super high copper content.
Right.
Then they were able to discover that there was another box of objects from this same site at a nearby museum. So they got that box and they were able to find a copper pot and a copper coin that probably this infant mummy was. The infant mummy would have been buried in the pot. And probably they put a copper coin in its hand.
Right.
And it's the antimicrobial properties of the copper that preserved the hand and also, you know, helped to preserve, turned green. You know how copper turns your hand green if you wear a copper ring or bracelet, okay? So that was kind of a mystery solved. It's not unusual for people to bury the dead with some kind of coin to pay the ferryman, you know, for passage into the passage into the next world.
Right.
And so anyway, it was interesting to for them to figure this out, and they found actually another couple of some other remains that and another copper pot. But then there was one that wasn't green, and they were wondering, now, why wasn't this infant buried in a pot?
Mm-hmm.
So, answered some questions and raised some questions.
All right. Well, it is interesting. And the last story we have is also somewhat scientific, although not entirely. And it has to do with AM and FM radio. It's written by Dan Neal, who is the car guy for the Wall Street Journal.
Well, he introduces it by saying road trips are great. They're usually during the daylight, but I like a nighttime road trip, and this is why.
And this is why. And the answer is that nighttime is the right time for AM radio, according to Dan Neal. Now, this is something I have never been able to keep straight, so I appreciated him setting me straight on FM and AM radio as to which is better during what times of day. He says, FM radio is a very strong straight-on signal. So if you have a line of sight to something or close to it, you can get the FM signal. AM, on the other hand, bounces around quite a bit, potentially in the atmosphere. And whereas FM is not benefited by the dark, AM is. Once you get in the evening, there's more bouncing around, and you have the potential for AM signals to traverse a longer distance, maybe even hundreds, if not thousands of miles. Now,
so that makes some sense.
Well,
I feel like as a young girl in Maryland, at night, I used to listen to some New York rock station.
Well, that may be, but let me just make one caveat here, because when I first heard this, it doesn't make sense. Because when I'm here, for example, I try to get the Met games on 710 here.
And you get a lot of interference.
And I can't get it at night. But the reason I have trouble getting it at night, which seems counterintuitive, is not because the signal doesn't travel, it's because the signal does. And just your point. It travels for a lot of other stations, too. So even though I'm getting a stronger signal from 710, I'm getting a stronger signal from all these weak stations in Pennsylvania and Jersey. So it strangely, I can't get it. But you are right. So you were getting rock stations in Maryland?
Yeah, Cousin Brucie.
Yeah, that's New York.
I feel like I listened to that as a kid.
First of all, this is shocking on two levels. One, that it went that far, and that you were listening to Cousin Brucie. I didn't know you were that kind of girl.
Learn something about me every day.
Apparently. Well, we'll have to continue this conversation later. But, so that's what his point is. His point in the article is that it's just fun. He says, frankly, AM radio is not that interesting. Anyways, but the idea of being able to get the signal, even if it's a commercial station, it might be syndicated, it might be nothing new, but even so, he'll just sort of experiment by driving along and see if he can get a signal from, let's say, Vancouver. He's in LA. Or from Nashville, where he's from.
Some of it's nostalgic, it seems, because he used to listen to that station when he lived in Nashville or whatever.
Here's one other nuance.
You're
right. It's nostalgic, but there's one other point he makes was important understanding this, and it goes back to Cousin Brucie. Because of the way AM signals run into each other, the FAA limits the power, the wattage that's put into the signal, except for certain grandfathered clear channel signals. There are certain clear channel signals. You apparently were getting one from New York, was allowed tremendous wattage. He talks about a clear channel signal that's WSMAM in Nashville, 650, which broadcast the Grand Ole Opry, and he says it helped popularize country music. It was a clear channel signal that was allowed to go throughout the United States, but there aren't that many of those. So in any event, it's a very informative, interesting article, and he talks about his hobby of driving out in the middle of nowhere and seeing what signals he's picking up. And at the end, he says, it leads to interesting conversations like, I'm not doing anything, officer, just sightseeing. So, you know, you have that part of it. But I've always find Daniel interesting, and I thought that was too. So that's all we have. Next weekend, Memorial Day weekend, as you put it, Tamsin, get the weenies together.
Get the weenies on the roaster.
Yes,
and we'll be back with Tamsin and Dan.
Read the paper.